auteur theory, the philosophy that a filmmaker applies highly centralized and subjective control to every aspect of a movie, that every frame is specifically created with a distinct vision in mind by its maker.
For this particular series, Rated P will be breaking down the filmography of the Coen brothers. We'll be analyzing each movie they've made, discussing their craft, and watching their signature style develop throughout their careers.
This week, it's 2016's Hail Caesar. Welcome to Rated P. I'm Brighton.
And I'm Yates. We are coming at you with another episode of Auteur Theory, this time on Hail Caesar, their penultimate film.
Yeah, and it's one that neither of us have seen before, and I would say it's pretty fair that it's different from their other stuff, but I want to start out by asking, Yates, did you enjoy Hail Caesar?
Yes, I did enjoy it. I think that it has a lot of fun things in the movie, a lot of enjoyable parts of it. However, I would not say that those things were necessarily related to the main course of the plot, and as a matter of fact, distracted from the main course of the plot. So while there were definitely fun aspects, the overall movie and arc of the movie as a whole was not necessarily that way.
Yeah, you described Inside Llewyn Davis as a lazy river, but I actually think that this one felt more like a lazy river to me than Inside Llewyn Davis, just because the plot in this one certainly seemed, the central storylines, it seemed like a side plot on its own, even though everything else going around it wasn't, you know, all that important to the central story that it is marketed by. I also enjoyed it. I also love movies about movies being made, like I'm a big Singing in the Rain fan. I loved La La Land. This one is an interesting take on that, and we're going to get into that here in a little bit, but I enjoyed that aspect of it and thought that it was really impressive in terms of them just dropping it in the middle of 1950s Hollywood. But certainly a different story structure and seemingly end goal for the Coens in this one than we've seen in plenty of their other projects.
Yeah, and I think that's absolutely true. And I think that that end goal is kind of where it differs from a movie like Inside Llewyn Davis. Because, you know, I feel like a lazy river, when I say Inside Llewyn Davis is a lazy river, it's because you don't really care, or at least I don't really care, like, where we're getting to. I kind of said the same thing about Little Women, where, like, you're just kind of watching it and it's delightful and it doesn't really matter where you end up. Whereas that is not, like, this is not a movie where it feels like you're just along for the ride. There is a place where it feels like you're going to eventually get, and it is a very slow movie that takes kind of a very lackadaisical approach to get there in a far less sensible or enjoyable way than a movie like those other two. And so that's how I would say this kind of differs. But, I mean, I think in terms of pacing and in terms of general plot structure, you're spot on, and that is kind of how this movie is structured, for better or for worse.
So let's dive into what actually happens in this movie for those who do not know. The synopsis is this movie largely follows 2 days in the life of studio head and boots-on-the-ground fixer Eddie Mannix, who works for Capitol Pictures in 1950s Hollywood. And he's just dealing with a lot of things in this movie, which seems like he's dealing with on a day-to-day basis. And we specifically see in this film, he's trying to figure out how to solve an issue of a famous actress who is pregnant and doesn't know who the father is, and he's trying to come up with a spin to make it look good. He's trying to figure out how to work a Western actor into a serious drama, and he's shooing off rival tabloid journalists seeking headlines, and he's, on top of all this, weighing whether or not to accept a job offer from an aerospace and defense company and to just leave the studio. But the most central storyline that's happening, the studio is shooting a big epic called Hail Caesar about a Roman who witnesses Jesus Christ and then converts to Christianity after having kind of an epiphany, which is very sort of based on Ben-Hur, is what the movie is supposed to kind of feel like. Only one problem with that, though: the lead for the film, Baird Whitlock, who is a big star, has gone missing. The audience sees how it all goes down, but the studio doesn't. Baird Whitlock has been kidnapped by what we later learn are communist screenwriters. And that sounds very Coen-y. ultimately nothing too serious happens with that storyline, though. Baird Whitlock makes it out okay. He hangs out with these communists, gets some of their ideas in his head, and eventually makes it back to the studio by the end of the night. A ransom gets paid, and then it gets lost, and the leader of the communist group hops into a Russian sub toward the end of the film.
Yeah, which, like, what?
This movie is a comedy, but it's a very kind of quirky sense of comedy. I don't think I found it as comedic as some of their other stuff, but it's certainly marketed as just a dry comedy in some ways. But that's pretty much it. We find out that Mannix ends up staying with the studio for another day. He passes up on this job opportunity. All the other storylines around it kind of tie off, and that is that. The main character, Eddie Mannix, is played by Josh Brolin. You have George Clooney in the Baird Whitlock role. You have a bunch of other stars in this movie. Channing Tatum, Scarlett Johansson, Ralph Fiennes, Jonah Hill makes a brief appearance. Frances McDormand makes a brief appearance. Tilda Swinton. Lots of really big actors, actresses, but it's very much a movie that's kind of broken up into vignettes, it feels like. Not overtly, but, you know, those actors or actresses come on for a scene or two and then they're gone again, or they come on for one scene and then there's a big break where all this other stuff is going on, and then it cuts back to them and we see them one more time, but that's it. It's certainly differently structured in terms of not being your normal story arc, and you know, there are some hijinks and some quirky things that happen along the way, but ultimately everything works out. Now, as I said, 1950s Hollywood. It's not like your normal period piece, but it definitely feels like it is sort of a love letter to this post-war period of making movies. And so, Yates, that's kind of where I wanted to start this discussion. Where do you think this movie kind of lines up in terms of its objective of showing this, or, you know, a movie about showing how movies are made compared to stuff like Singin' in the Rain, stuff like Once Upon a Time in Hollywood, and maybe even La La Land?
Yeah, I think that, you know, this is a love letter to Hollywood is pretty complicated, because it seems like a lot of, you know, by having it center around a studio head or a studio executive, instead of, you know, all these other movies that you've mentioned has been centered around the actors and kind of the stars of the time. You know, centering around behind the scenes, it portrays things as a love letter, portrays things in the way that, you know, all these other love letter movies have, but then it also shows a lot of, you know, once the camera's cut, it shows a lot of the things about Hollywood that really were not that good at the time. Like, you know, kind of controlling actors and actresses and depriving them of their own free will, even in some ways. You know, the fact that the movie opens up with Mannix, you know, destroying camera film because the studio owns a woman's appearance and she can't have pictures taken of her that aren't, you know, taken by and owned by the studio. And so it definitely gets a lot more into kind of the evilness of movie studios at the time, especially through the whole storyline with Baird Whitlock, when he kind of becomes awoken to that. And then Eddie Mannix literally slaps it out of him, and, you know, kind of reaffirms and controls studio power, studio authority in a way that does not portray Hollywood and the studios all that well when all said and done.
Yeah, it's interesting that we got that kind of look at it from Barton Fink very early on in the Coen's filmography, where in that one, the main character is a writer who has just been brought to Hollywood and is kind of seeing this from a fresh eyes perspective, whereas in this film, it's showing the perspective of the studio head, somebody who's absolutely entrenched in this kind of culture and very much is the one who is letting it purvey, if you want to put it that way. And you know, he's supposed to be relatable, Josh Brolin's character, and I think he is to an extent, but it also is kind of where it suffers, because we see that stuff happen, as you mentioned, Yates, but there's not a whole lot about him or really about too many other people in this movie that I think they take enough time to sit you down and make the audience really try and be like, okay, I feel emotionally connected to what happens to any of them. And I think that's where it kind of goes downhill. Getting back to it being a love letter in some ways, this movie, upon having a couple days to reflect on it, it includes a lot of very subtle references to things that actually happen. And I feel like it's the inclusion of those that most make it a love letter, because otherwise, the rest of it does feel kind of critical to how Hollywood was operated at the time and maybe is reflective of how it still is like this in some ways. But the way that it feels like a love letter is, as I said, the way that they include some of this stuff, like the fact that Eddie Mannix was a real guy and he might have actually been like this. And so that they decide to do a main character that is a real life person, which does not happen hardly at all in the Coen Brothers movies, but also the inclusion of other details, storylines and plot points. Right. So Scarlett Johansson's character is pregnant with this child and they decide, well, she's going to adopt her own daughter to make it look like, even though it is her kid, she doesn't know who the father is, by doing it this way, the press will think that she is just adopting her. That actually happened with Loretta Young in the 1930s. She got pregnant with Clark Gable, but then Gable then moved on, and Loretta Young hid her daughter away for 19 months until she adopted her in the paper's perspective. In addition to that, the whole sort of side plot line of the On Wings of Eagles in Hail Caesar might have actually happened with Clark Gable, according to research. Which what? Is very interesting. Yeah, whoa. Yeah. There's also a very punny joke in there about spaghetti westerns, literally. And even the dueling twin sister columnists have some real life people to draw inspiration from, because there were newspaper advice columnists named Ann Landers and Abigail Van Buren, who were twin sisters, and they were writing Dear Abby columns, essentially, and kind of duking it out with each other in different publications. And we get that with Tilda Swinton's character in this, where she plays twin sisters who are very over the top. So I feel like it's the inclusion of those things that make it the love letter. But when you look at it on its face, it's not, it doesn't quite feel that way.
Yes, I absolutely agree. And I think that that's one of the most Coen-y aspects of this movie, is kind of how it takes that love letter genre of movies, you know, that you've talked about, like Singing in the Rain or La La Land or, you know, countless others. And it does turn that on its head. And it does kind of, not only in the way that I already said, show you the actors, show you the studio heads and execs instead of the actors, but it also shows you a lot of the unpleasantries and exactly what you just kind of depicted, and bases it on real life things. So it kind of shows you how things were, and not necessarily the romanticized version that we tend to get.
Now, I think that in addition to that, there's also a big inclusion of religion in this movie, a huge inclusion of religion. I mean, the entire movie that they are making, that this movie is kind of centered on, is about religion, is about Christianity. I think that they include that, and I tried to figure out why. From what I can tell, they included it, showing the idea that kind of Hollywood itself, that being in films, making films itself, is sort of its own religion, right? You have to believe a certain amount of things. You have to buy into this mentality, dedicate yourself to this path in a way, in order to make it, or in order to stay within this studio culture. And, you know, in addition to obviously the allusions and stuff like that to Jesus in the Hail Caesar movie, you also have Josh Brolin's main character. We see him go to confessional twice, and he's confessing things that aren't all that bad, and he goes pretty regularly. He's like, he freaks out a little bit when it's over a day since he's gone and confessed. And on top of that, there's also a lot of talking with religious leaders from different faiths, asking if it's okay if they're doing a movie like this and showing a Godhead in this way. Actually, a quick side note here. In the credits, Yates, I don't know if you caught this, but it does say at one point in the credits, this motion picture contains no visual depiction of the Godhead.
That is hilarious. Yeah. That is really funny. I mean, especially because of what the rabbi says and, you know, I mean, Joel and Ethan Cohen's religious upbringing.
So while that scene is funny with all the religious leaders there, I also think it's meant to show how committed all of them are to their different faiths, because they're arguing how a Godhead should be depicted. But we also kind of get this commitment to faith and a mentality with the communist writers as well. They are so committed to their belief in trying to convert people to communism that one of them even goes on a pilgrimage. He hops in a sub and goes to Russia.
Well, and before we dive too much into that, just real quick, I also want to point out, you know, Eddie Mannix seated at the head of that table kind of is represented as the leader of the religion of Hollywood, almost.
Yeah, 100%.
I think that's actually credit to you for that idea that you said to me earlier. But, I mean, you know, I do think that a lot of that and that idea of kind of the religion of Hollywood is really important in this film with that scene. And then, yeah, I mean, kind of I think that everything with the communist writers kind of does play into that in terms of, you know, you have religious dissidents and all that stuff. And that's kind of who the communist writers represent with Hollywood.
Absolutely. And it gets, I think, even nailed home further, or maybe what kind of put what kind of finalized me looking at it this way was how Brolin's character through the movie keeps getting this other job offer from a steady job, but it's doing something totally different from what he's doing with Capitol Pictures. And it's very much like a temptation. He is tempted by cigarettes in this movie, which he continually like goes in and is like, oh, I'm trying to quit. And I'm lying to my wife about not quitting. But I definitely think that this other job offer to leave Hollywood is very much kind of like a temptation, or like, you know, a sin in some way. And he ends up staying with the studio. He chooses to go the harder route is how it's described, the more difficult route to stay in this business, because he sees it as like the right thing to do. He's so committed to this and really believes that working in this way for entertainment is not exactly the righteous path, but the right thing for him to do. And then, yeah, you kind of talked about it when he is slapping around Baird after Baird returns and makes him stop talking about those communist theories. That is certainly reflective of, you know, him kind of nailing down this mentality of how you have to be in Hollywood. And we already had these connections to Barton Fink being that same way. And the fact that, I don't even know if I mentioned this, Capitol Pictures is the studio that Barton Fink goes to write for in Barton Fink. And so absolute connections there. I'm going to just read that passage really quick, Yates, that Eddie says when he's telling Baird Whitlock to stop talking about the communist stuff. He says to Baird, shut up. You're going to go out there and you're going to finish Hail Caesar. You're going to give that speech at the feet of the penitent thief, and you're going to believe every word you say. And then he hits him two more times and he says, you're going to do it because you're an actor and that's what you do. Just like the director does what he does, and the writer and the script girl and the guy who claps the slate. You're going to do it because the picture has worth, and you have worth if you serve the picture, and you're never going to forget that again. And so I definitely think it's that specific wording, talking about worth and serving the picture, serving the studio in that way because it is his role to do so. I absolutely just think that kind of nails everything down, and it's probably one of the most climactic moments of the movie too. It hammers home that this is kind of the message that they were trying to put across.
And I think that kind of, you know, if taking into account their most religion centric movie to date, A Serious Man, and kind of the view that seems to adopt of religion, plus this showing a lot of the flaws of Hollywood and comparing it to religion, I do think it kind of complicates the, you know, the Coens' kind of overall view that they convey through their filmography on religion. And I mean, that's too much to get into and try and answer that question right now. But I do think that this is kind of another interesting piece of that puzzle.
So with that being said, you mentioned A Serious Man, and we'd been talking about Barton Fink a little bit. So kind of looking at religion through a different lens is something they've done in their past movies. But this movie, Hail Caesar, does not feel very Coen-y in a lot of other ways. And I wanted to, if you could start us off here, I'm really curious to what your thoughts, what jumped out to you in terms of what Coen elements this movie was missing more than others?
You know, it did not feel very Coen-y in terms of overall plot structure. I will say, you know, it seems like a lot of their movies that we talk about is just kind of things spinning out of control more and more. And this did not really have that. You know, this almost actually seemed like the opposite, where it was total control by the studio of everything that was happening.
Well, not quite, because they don't know where he goes, and they wouldn't have ever gotten him back.
Well, but even when things don't go according to their plan, they always are like, we can fix this, we have the means to fix this, and we're going to fix it. Like it never seems like it gets away from them, like it does in other movies, like No Country for Old Men, or, you know, whatever, Fargo. And so while, yes, things do not go according to plan, they never really just like spin out of control, because Eddie Mannix has the resources to prevent that from happening. And he's never, I mean, even when the Tsar goes missing and they get the ransom note, it's like, we need $100,000. He's like, okay. Like he doesn't even like miss a beat there.
Yeah. It's just, it's very mild. I think it is there, but it is incredibly mild and not all that quirky. And another thing is, you know, I feel like if there had been actual fear that George Clooney's character was in any sort of peril, that might change things. But the communist writers just want to kind of convert him. Yeah, there's no real sense of danger. And so it's just like, well, you know, he's missing for a day. The worst thing that's happening is that they just can't shoot this big movie for a day. And he ends up, you know, being fine.
And I think that basically everything that you're saying right there kind of almost goes back to your point about True Grit and the fact that this is a PG-13 movie, and it certainly seems like if it was R and they were able to kind of show more of like, and had gone in the direction of a little bit more dangerous, a little bit more gritty, you know, some more kind of like yikes or, you know, nerve-wracking things happen to Baird Whitlock or really to anyone, I do think it would have been a better movie. And so I or at least more interesting with higher emotional stakes and more Coen. And so kind of just going back to the argument you made about True Grit, I think that that applies here just as much, if not even more, than it did there.
Absolutely. And, you know, it's hard to say whether they went out with the intention of making this movie PG-13, like they wanted to make it more chill to appeal to more audiences. But the fact that it has absolutely no violence in it and there's nobody that dies is just very different from Coen Brothers movies. Now, I'm not saying that's a bad thing. Of course, you never want anybody to die, but that's so different. I don't think we've had a Coen Brothers movie where not a single person has some sort of untimely fate. And this one, there's not even any moments of violence besides when Eddie is slapping around Baird in his office. That alone just makes it feel very interesting. And I think goes right back to the sense of, you know, you don't ever really feel like he's in true danger. You're just kind of wondering what's going on, and you're as confused as he is, but you never really fear for him. One of the things that I wanted to mention for why it doesn't feel particularly Coen-y either is the dialogue. The dialogue is pretty good in this movie. I kind of feel how I did about Inside Llewyn Davis. There are moments in here, there are quick conversations, snappy parts of it where you're like, okay, yeah, this is Coen dialogue, and it's certainly not bad, but it's not to the level of dropping you in a specific point in time or a specific place and giving you all this dialect, all these kind of phrases and stuff like that, that seem incredibly central, localized. You could only find them here. In this one, it seems pretty generic. They're not using any particular lingo or anything like that that feels either 1950s or that feels Hollywood. And I kind of miss it. I feel like this would have been a good opportunity to go kind of along those lines. And again, there's some sharp moments, but I certainly wouldn't say it's one of the better parts of the movie.
And even the sharp moments, I feel like, are few and far between. And when you have a movie from the Coens that, you know, is not quite as, because, I mean, you know, I think that treating this as a period piece is a little more, there are more gray areas than just is it or is it not. And so I do think that you can kind of say, well, it's the period specific dialogue or location specific dialogue or whatever could kind of get lost in the margins there. But that aside, a lot of the quippiness and just kind of how finely crafted and well crafted their dialogue usually is, I feel like you don't even get that in this.
I'd say you get a little bit in the scenes where he is talking to the twin sisters. But that's the majority of it. That's the majority of it. And the scene with the religious leaders.
That's the other one I was going to say. But I mean, you know, all of it where you kind of start to get a little bit of it with the communist writers, but even what you do get, I feel like, is not among their best, and it's so few and far between that, you know, it's really not a factor in the movie.
I think an honorable mention for that is the scene with Jonah Hill's one scene where they're trying to figure out what to find somebody to pass this baby off to. No, I agree. And you talked about the story structure a little bit. All the storylines in this one are largely tied up at the end, but it just doesn't feel the same way as it does in their other ones where you're like, oh, thank goodness, we got this figured out. We got this little detail figured out. You don't feel the same way because I don't think you're as invested in the characters, and the central storyline just doesn't feel very central. And so that's kind of my issue with it. Now, as we said, there are some moments you get a suitcase full of cash again that's ultimately lost. And you get some, you know, references to other stuff, but I gotta say, it's just a very, very different feel from the rest of their stuff. And I don't think it's a bad movie, but it's a movie it's either like you have to think of it in a really critical way, or you have to just be kind of putting it on for not mindless 1950s Hollywood stuff, but you gotta be putting it on with like, okay, I just want to see something that looks like old Hollywood. Or else there's not a whole lot to get out of it.
Yeah, I absolutely agree.
I think that about covers it. I have more things that I did like about it that we'll hop into when we get into categories and stuff like that. But before we do, box office numbers for this one. It was made on a $22 million budget, so kind of middle of the road in terms of where their budgets have fallen. I think that's kind of cheap compared to the star power that they got in this movie. But considering that the star power that they got probably only had to be on set for like a handful of days, that makes sense. It made $30 million stateside, which is not all that high, again, when you look at the star power that is in this movie, and $33 million overseas, so a $63 million worldwide gross. This is one of their more recent films, so it's a little their last film that has been in theaters, so not a huge take there, certainly compared to some of the previous ones that we had just mentioned, but you could say it's more of a blockbuster than Inside Llewyn Davis was, which very much felt like it was an award movie and came out in an award time slot. Hopping into tidbits and trivia, Yates, I was kind of bummed. I could not find all that many casting rumors and people who almost got casted or who they had in mind that they couldn't get. And I think this goes back to what we had said with Inside Llewyn Davis. They are now seen as, you know, some of the cream of the crop in Hollywood. So I think it's just easier for them to get the people that they want, and more interesting people are down to sign on for these. However, there are a lot of hidden Coen favorites or people that have made small appearances or other appearances in Coen Brothers movies of the past that are in this one that almost too many to go through, but it's a lot of fun to see all those familiar faces. One of the pieces of information I found, this doesn't surprise me very much, though. Like many projects of the Coens, they kicked it around in their heads for a while before they actually got it done. They actually originally pitched this idea, Yates, to George Clooney in 1999 before they even shot O Brother, Where Art Thou? Now, they had a different vision for it and a different setting. It was going to be set in the 1920s, and it was about a play of Caesar and stuff like that. But it was going to be kind of a comedy as well, where the lead guy in the play was not all that intelligent and gets wrapped up in stuff. I also read this definitely seems like it's some sort of internet research rumor stuff, but it could be true. Apparently Clooney once said to the press that Hail Caesar was going to be his next movie as a joke before anything even happened, just knowing that it was a Coen Brothers reference. And then there was so much buzz that was created from that content that it actually spurred the Coens to kind of go ahead and start writing this movie and creating it in the first place. So I don't know if that's true. It'd be funny if it was. I also feel like it helps explain maybe why it turned out the way that it did.
You know what? You're not wrong.
Some interesting news about the cast that actually was in the movie for his role as Hobie Doyle, who I absolutely love as a character in this movie. I thought Hobie was great.
Great. Just truly, truly a delight.
Alden Ehrenreich actually had to learn horseback riding, rope tricks, twirling guns, and playing the guitar for all of his scenes. So he was actually doing all that stuff. And he said afterwards that the hardest part of it was actually twirling the spaghetti to mimic the lasso. He said that was the most difficult part, the most difficult thing that he had to learn out of all the other things that he did. So that's pretty impressive. All that stuff to go along with a great performance.
That kind of makes sense, though. I can't imagine that using spaghetti as a lasso is an easy feat to accomplish.
No, I agree. Somebody else who had to learn a lot for his role, Channing Tatum, did not know how to tap dance. And I was wondering this when watching the scene where he is in a musical and they're doing a big music number in a bar, but he's actually tap dancing in that scene. He learned after weeks and weeks of practicing how to do that stuff. So power to Channing Tatum. Obviously, he was a dancer before, but a very different kind of dancing, if you know what I mean. Moving on.
We're talking about stripping.
Magic Mike.
Yeah. And Magic Mike XXL.
Eddie Mannix's secretary mentions that his meeting with the four religious leaders takes place in the Wallace Beery conference room. Wallace Beery is a name that we have heard before because it is referenced in Barton Fink. He is supposed to be writing a wrestling movie starring real-life actor Wallace Beery for Capital Pictures. So lots of little Easter eggs in there. And
wait, he's supposed to be writing a what?
A wrestling picture.
A wrestling picture!
Yes.
Anyway.
Michael
Lerner and Barton Fink, all time, is beautiful.
Another little Easter egg here, but it's not Coen stuff. It's communist stuff. Ingalls, who is the communist dog who Channing Tatum catches instead of the suitcase full of cash, is actually a reference to Frederick Ingalls, who was a friend of Karl Marx and who actually helped co-founded the Marxist theory. So some little inside baseball for communism there. And this might be the most fun piece of trivia yet, Yates. The guy who gets out of the Russian sub in an uncredited role, Dolph Lundgren.
What?
Dolph Lundgren. They asked him to do it, and he was thrilled. He was like, I never thought that the Coens would ever want me in a movie. Initially, that scene was going to be a lot longer, and unfortunately, it got almost entirely cut. So there's no way to tell that that's him. But in the scene where a Russian sub just emerges from the water, the guy who gets out of the hatch is Dolph Lundgren.
That is... that's hilarious.
It is hilarious. I love that. All right, let's move on to favorite scene. I've got four. Do you want me to run you through mine, or do you have a couple you want to start off with?
You go ahead, and then if I have any that do not overlap, which I'm actually kind of guessing I might not, go for it.
All right. So I feel like mine kind of reflect what I like about these Hollywood movies anyways. I love the scene where Hobie is trying to shoot the fancy drama, the costume drama, and Lawrence Lorenz is continuously coaching the line. The fact that they repeated that line, like, what was it? Like 20, 30,
so many times.
40 times. Hilarious.
Yeah. Well, and I also had that one. And I think that scene also kind of just says a lot about Hollywood at the time too, where it's just like, yeah, we have the star people, like, he'll make us money. It doesn't matter how good he is in the movie. He'll, you know, whatever. which it seems like that wouldn't, I mean, you know, explain how they made Great Wall with Matt Damon. But other than that one example, it seems like that doesn't really happen today. But yeah, no, I also had that one, and the chemistry between
Deirdre,
I was gonna say between Lawrence Lawrence and Hobart, was really good, and I'm kind of sad that we didn't get to see more of them on screen together.
I love Ray Fiennes. I thought he did a great job as Lawrence Lawrence. I actually do think that this still happens in Hollywood, right? They move him to this picture because they're like, all right, we're going to change his career arc up. He's been a Western guy, but now we're going to make him like, we're going to put him in other stuff. That totally happens. Agents help, you know, move their actors from certain movies to different kinds in order to make them bigger stars.
Yeah, well, in agents do, but it's also like, it seems like you pretty rarely have a studio teledirector who they have to cast with no ifs, ands, or buts about it.
That is true. That would not happen these days, that's for sure.
Yeah, that's kind of what I mean. And I mean, once you get agents and everything involved, then yeah, everything changes.
The next one that I have down is the swinging dinghy scene where it's a big musical number with sailors and stuff like that, with Channing Tatum taking the lead. I liked it just because it felt very much like an homage to Singing in the Rain. It was shot in a pretty engaging way. It's cool that you see both what the camera is seeing and what the people who are behind the camera are looking at. There are a couple times where it's like in the middle of the number, but then it goes back and you see the entire soundstage that they're on, and Josh Brolin's character walks in. I don't know. I thought it was a pretty interesting way of showing these scenes that anybody who used to watch these movies during this time period would see, and then showing kind of what's going on behind it. Also, pretty impressive dancing and choreography. The other two that I have, the scene with Joel Silverman, as I mentioned earlier, the one Jonah Hill scene, I thought it was funny. I loved it for dialogue. I thought it was good lighting. And it's one of the few times where we actually get some of the biggest stars on screen together. It just felt very Coen-y. And the last one is when Channing Tatum hops into the Russian sub. Not because I think it's a particularly great scene, but I thought the music is really funny in that scene. I thought that the sub itself looked pretty convincing. I also like that it just makes very little sense. I like that it's kind of ridiculous.
So I also had the Jonah Hill scene. I thought that scene was great. He's great. And that also says a ton about movie studios in general. And interesting fact, there was a rumor at one point that Clark Gable hit someone with his car and MGM studio covered up by sending someone else to jail, which is what happens with Joe Silverman in that. So that's a little another interesting tidbit. But it's wild to me that my favorite scene, and what I thought was the best scene, you did not include, which was the religious leader's conversation, which I thought was just – I thought it had some of the best dialogue, some of the best insight kind of into what this movie was ultimately about. I thought that was one of the funnier and more engaging scenes and probably, yeah, what I thought was the best one.
It's really good. I'm not entirely sure why I didn't have it on the list. I think it was more that happens pretty early on, and so maybe I just wasn't looking for it and didn't know how much of meaning it was going to end up holding. I would still argue, though, since we both have it, maybe we choose the Hobie and Lawrence Lawrence scene as our favorite.
That for me is a close second. So if we have to have one for both of us, I will concede that can be it.
All right, favorite quotes. I've got really just two. Again, it goes back to the lack of great dialogue, I think. I don't know. There's just not all that much stuff that's quotable or like gut-bustingly funny. I mentioned earlier the Eddie Mannix slapping Baird around. I really think that whole couple lines is really well written, and I think it goes to show what the movie is about. So I have that one written down. But in that scene with the religious leaders, this one made me chuckle, is when he's describing, Eddie Mannix is describing the movie to the religious leaders, and he says, "We're working hard to bring to the screen the story of Christ. It's a swell story." Just like describing the story of Jesus Christ is swell. Just a swell story. Just crack me up for some reason. Like, it's like, yeah, there are four dudes sitting in this room who, like, you know, they study a religious being for their entire life. Like, and he's just like, yeah, we're gonna, it's gonna be swell. It's gonna be so great.
I had written down one specific quote from that scene, and then in parentheses under it, really just like that whole scene. I thought that a lot of dialogue in that scene is great, but the very last line in that scene, after they've been like discussing and arguing and like all this stuff for the whole time, Eddie Mannix goes and he asks every leader individually, you know, what do you think? And they all are like, yeah, it's fine, like, whatever. And then he asks the rabbi, and the rabbi, after arguing with all of them, goes, I haven't an opinion, which is just, it's leading up to like this whole thing. Another honorable mention from that scene is right off the bat at the very beginning, he asks all the leaders like what they thought of the movie and if it accurately like depicts everything. And the one of the leaders is like, well, I thought it was a little unrealistic when he was jumping from chariot to chariot while they were moving.
And he's like, yeah, it's we can work on that.
Yeah, exactly. But it's not even remotely what he was asking about. So, but yeah, really, really, that whole scene could be nominated.
I'm gonna go. My favorite. I think I'm gonna go with that line between Beard and Eddie. I just think there's so much that's lying in it, and the importance of it. So, that's mine.
Yeah, I think that's, you know, I think that's. In terms of a line that kind of encapsulates the entire movie and what it's about, I think that one is spot on. So, yep, I am totally, totally, totally down with that.
Recasting ideas, I have three.
Really?
I have three.
Interesting. That was one thing I thought was done really well in this movie.
It is done really well, but I think that we can get some of the older Coen Brothers favorites into this one, despite the inclusion of many, many newer ones. First up, John Goodman has got to be the bartender in the swingin' dinghy. He should be the bartender in the swingin' dinghy scene.
What if John Polito was the bartender in the swingin' dinghy scene?
See, I have John Polito playing Eddie Mannix. I think Josh Brolin is doing a great John Polito impression through almost this entire movie.
Yeah. Yeah. I can see that.
I miss John Polito.
Yeah, I do too. He's great.
Do you have any others?
No, I mean, as I said, I thought that this movie was really, really, really well casted.
All right, my last one's kind of goofy. All right, picture this.
Oh, no.
The Russian sub comes up out of the water.
Oh, no.
The hatch opens. We cut to Channing Tatum's face as he looks at it in anticipation. Out climbs a majestic, confident man, M. Emmett Walsh, as the Russian.
Oh my god!
Could have happened, but you know, Dolph Lundgren, a close.
Yeah,
how
are you
gonna
replace Dolph Lundgren in this movie? Get out of here!
We gotta
get
M. Emmett Walsh in. That's why.
Okay, then put M. Emmett Walsh. Okay, actually, I do have one, not M. Emmett Walsh. Steve Buscemi as one of the communists.
That would have been good.
As one of, yeah. I mean, I feel like that would have been an opportunity. It could have been like all. You could have just had a ton of different like. Like, Emmett Walsh could have been the, like, one old communist. You could have had John Turturro as the tall, skinny communist. You had Cy Abelman as a communist, which was great. We love Cy Abelman. So, yeah. But, I mean, as a whole, they had a ton of stars who all did a pretty, pretty dang good job.
We haven't seen Buscemi in a while. I hope, I hope he's doing all right. I know he's making Boardwalk Empire at this point, but, like, come on.
I didn't even know he was in that.
I think so. I could have just completely messed that up. All right, heat check. I think it's fair to say the majority of performances in this movie, besides Eddie Mannix, are kind of heat check performances. Like, everybody is really quirky. Everybody's off the wall. And it was kind of refreshing to see that after it was not like that in Inside Llewyn Davis or True Grit. But at the same time, like...
Or A Serious Man.
Yeah, but at the same time, it's like you can only do it to some extent, and when the rest of the story is kind of weak, it's a bummer. It feels like they're relying on those quirky characters just a little too much. However, I've got three people written down for heat check. The first one, Tilda Swinton, and
for sure,
I think she is hilarious in this movie. Not just because she's a journalist, but like the outfit she's wearing is great. How she's having to play two twins, I think, is great. She's pretty great in every single scene that she's in. Now, she's in more scenes than other people, So I don't know if that completely invalidates her for heat check here, but I would like to put her in. We'll see if she makes it. I think Frances McDormand deserves a nomination here.
I did not even think about her, but abso-freaking-lutely.
She's in one scene cutting some spools, some reels of film together, and she gets her scarf stuck in it. And it's almost choking. And then the first thing that she does when her scarf comes out is she takes a long drag from the cigarette and just poofs it right in Josh Brolin's face.
and then kind of mumbles like I gotta stop wearing scarves or like whatever. It's great.
The last one, and it's not because she does an exceptional job or she's quirky or anything like that, but I found her funny. The vacuum cleaner lady in the communist in the Malibu Beach house, she just does not care one bit about George Clooney. She does not care one bit about the communists that are using the house. I found her funny and thought she deserved a nomination.
Yeah, I think that your analysis of pretty much like a lot of people in this movie are a heat check is pretty spot on. You could even argue for ScarJo. You could argue for Jonah Hill. You could kind of make an argument even for like it's for George Clooney is kind of doing a heat check. It's in a little bit too much of a movie, a little bit too much of the movie to really make that argument. But I mean, he is giving a heat check-ish performance. I feel like it's got to be Tilda Swinton with her playing two different characters.
Oh, I forgot one. The old guy in the Western movie who's like the crazy, like, the guy who's arguing with the moon.
Oh,
definitely deserves to be in the conversation here.
That Western movie, it as someone who loved Westerns, I hated that scene.
Just because it was like, so generic?
Well, no, it's like, you know, all the Westerns from the time period that, like, I love are just, like, very, like, serious, like, Sergio Leone, Clint Eastwood, like chewing on his cigars and wasting people and, like, are gritty. And then, and so, like, I don't know, just seeing a more goofy Western, I don't know. I was kind of like, ugh. I'm a purist of the genre, so... I don't know. That scene, the people in the theater thought it was so much funnier than it actually was.
I agree.
Which really, I was like, come on, guys.
They were really selling it.
But he was going for it. I was really like going to give it to Tilda Swinton, but he really is heat checking it.
He really is heat checking it.
He really is.
I feel like it's either him or Frances McDormand. I think Tilda Swinton's in it just a little too much.
Yeah, and she has that's fair, and I guess she does kind of have a relatively important part of the plot tied to her too
at the end.
So yeah, so that's fair. All right. Well, I'll defer to you here. Dealer's choice.
I'll go with Frances McDormand just because it's a more subtle one. But I agree. I didn't find the guy in the Western all that funny, whereas I found her hilarious.
And because we love Frances
McDormand. We love Frances McDormand. I want to see her more involved with some Coen projects down the road. We'll see if that happens. And the award goes to... I couldn't come up with a lot of people when I was first thinking of this, but having a couple days, I have some ideas written down here. I think Josh Brolin needs to be in the conversation.
Yes.
Since, you know, I'm sure this movie works without him. But the movie doesn't work without his character, that's for sure.
The movie doesn't really work anyway, but that's fine.
I think Alden Ehrenreich deserves to be in the conversation here because he's great as Hobie.
He's really good, and if I'm not mistaken, this was kind of one of his first like big roles.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. He might have been cast as Solo either right before this movie came out or shortly after this movie came out, somewhere in that role, but it certainly helped set him up. I think the production designers need to be in the conversation for this because the Capitol Pictures lots are awesome. And if I'm sure they shot on location at like an actual old studio somewhere, made it look like that at the very least, but the sound stages that they built and then knowing that they're having to shoot in sound stages themselves, or in some places you're making a sound stage that's on a sound stage. It was pretty impressive. And the costumes and all that stuff that went into it were great, and all the old cars and all that stuff. I thought it was really impressive.
And I mean, I thought that they really quintessentially captured the feel of a lot of different 1950s type movies, which was really, really, really impressive. Yeah, I mean, I think there's absolutely an argument to be made there.
The last one I have is it's got a question mark beside it, so, because I don't know if it is completely worthy, but does post-war Hollywood deserve to be in the conversation for any of the award goes to?
How many post-war Hollywood movies can you name?
Pretty few. Pretty few. So there you go. All right, let's tack that in. Of those four, which one stands out?
I think Josh Brolin is good. I don't think he's great. I think Alden Ehrenreich is great, but I think the production design is better. And I think that post-war Hollywood is an honorable mention.
Yeah, I think that's where I am too. What I'm going to remember when I think of Hail Caesar, I think, is like, wow, they did a really good job of showing you Hollywood behind the scenes, but Hollywood behind the scenes decades ago. And I think that's largely because of production design.
And also Alden Ehrenreich did a great job.
Yeah.
But that's kind of like a footnote.
Yeah.
Yeah.
All right. Could someone else have made this movie? I 100% think so. And there's a very real chance that somebody else could have made this and it would have been better.
Wes Anderson?
Wes Anderson making this would have been so much fun. I would have loved to have seen that. Great nomination. Great nomination. I wrote down Hitchcock because I think Hitchcock could do the whole kidnapped movie star thing pretty well.
Really well.
Pretty well.
I actually have one more. Lawrence Lorentz, I feel like, could do a good job with this one. Lawrence Lorentz presents.
Twitter was so simple.
I think you're spot on. I think that a lot of people could have made this movie. Written it, maybe not, but in terms of execution, yeah, I'm Wes Anderson is my nominee. And I think Hitchcock would be interesting too.
All right. I think from our discussion, it's pretty clear that this one is going to be ranked low. Now the question is, how low should it be ranked? Because it doesn't feel particularly Coen-y. There are some elements in there.
A couple, but they're not even done super well when they are.
And they're not that strong. And Yates, I think it's, despite this being one of their more recent movies, their last movie to have actually hit theaters, I think we're going to have to send it to a pretty bad place.
To the wood chipper.
Yeah, it's a real shame. I had my hopes up for this one, but I just don't think it was I don't think it's as good as many of their other things, and it certainly didn't have the same ingredients that we've seen other of their movies that we haven't enjoyed all that much have that felt more Coen-y.
Yep, I agree on all counts. So where does that put us?
That puts us with one more Coen Brothers movie to go. And it's another one that's pretty different, I think, in terms of the execution, and certainly different in terms of its presentation, because it is their first Netflix exclusive film, and that is The Ballad of Buster Scruggs, a 2018 Western anthology movie that we'll be talking about next week.
Before then, though, we will also be continuing our heist movie showdown extravaganza, however you want to put it. And so, yeah, we'll be continuing that on Friday before we get to Buster Scruggs next Tuesday.
Yeah, we knocked out half the bracket. We'll be doing the next half this time. So be sure to check out that bracket on our social medias. You can follow us at Rated P Podcast on Twitter. You can like our Facebook page as well. And follow us on Letterboxd to see what else we're watching.
We'll see you Friday.